The monks of Newskeet, longtime breeders of German Shepherds and renowned dog trainers of all breeds, have co-developed a new training technique. In their new book, The Art of Training Your Dog, How to Gently Teach Good Behavior Using an E-Collar, the monks and Mark Goldberg, who pioneered the approach, offer a leap into the future using this game-changing tool, the remote electronic collar. Using a light touch, one that many humans can't even feel, at just the right moment, they say helps to focus a dog's attention, and the authors help to create effortless teaching moments that tie into your dog's natural pack instincts and help strengthen the bond with your dog. Again, the name of the book is The Art of Training Your Dog, How to Gently Teach Good Behavior Using an E-Collar, and it's a pleasure to welcome Brother Christopher back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you very much, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's get this out of the way first. I will confess this up front to Brother Christopher, and that is, I have gotten letters from people who said you shouldn't interview the monks because this training technique is cruel. And so let's just begin there and get that out of the way, because I'm certainly not the first person to say this to you.
Do you think? No, it's... Yeah. It's entirely understandable that you'd ask that question. The use of e-collars in dog training is both controversial and, in a sense, polarizing with those that feel any use of an e-collar is inhumane versus those that simply can't think of going back to the way training was done, let's say, 25 years ago. To be truthful, 20 years ago, I would not have been thinking of using e-collars in our work here in the monastery at all, and would have probably thought of them as useful only in, for example, field work or dealing with exceedingly difficult problems that endangered a dog's life. For example, dogs that prey on livestock or seriously aggressive dogs. I mean, for real situations where a dog was risking being euthanized. However, my attitude changed very much when, in 2006, I met both Mark Goldberg and learned of the work that he was doing with e-collars. And what I became aware of is that the technology had changed dramatically over the past years, and that e-collars were now capable of being used in an extremely subtle way. And given that you incorporate a sound teaching device and a program that allows dogs to understand a mild stim in a way that communicates the desire. What I saw with my own eyes and began to experience in my own work was something nothing short of revolutionary. And I had gone to a week-long seminar, and it just opened my eyes to how these could be used in a way that transformed a relationship between owner and dog, because most dog owners have a dream. They have a dream of being able to both live with their dogs and take their dogs on hikes where the dog can be off leash safely and where there's not a fear that the dog is going to ignore, for example, a recall under distracted circumstances. And in the work that I've been doing over the past, let's say, 15 years, what I've seen is those very real ambitions that owners have can be realized in ways that are actually quite difficult to realize when you're doing simply conventional training.
So with that said, let us talk about the obstacles of why training is so hard in the first place. I come to you, Brother Christopher, as a man who has a 5-month, 3-week-old yellow lab puppy. So, I need your help. Now,
right.
What is it about that makes training so necessary and why it is so challenging and why it is so hard?
Well, I think there are a number of potential answers to that question that actually probably interrelate. I think one thing, we love our dogs. And when we're working with a young dog, I think many owners, one, want the dog to like us, okay, and so feel that assuming an appropriate relationship of leadership is going to, in some sense, compromise that the dog is not going to like them for being a leader figure. So that would be one thing that goes into it. But secondly, I think also owners often project human emotions onto the dog. They anthropomorphize the dog and sort of project a lot of perhaps mistaken assumptions into the training process. For example, that force is going to accomplish their goals. And also, frankly, in our busy world, a lot of owners simply don't have the time or patience to be consistent in working with their young dog in a program of obedience. So I think all of those things go into the reality that here at the monastery, for example, we get an awful lot of clients bringing their dogs for help.
You bring up a fascinating point and one that I have been ruminating on here for a while, which is the time aspect of it. One of the things that COVID has brought is that I and my wife, we have more time with our dog. We are home. We are spending time with our dog. And while we had that, the dog had the alone time, we had the alone time, we don't have that. So it seems to me that there are opportunities there that perhaps we are not taking advantage of because we are not doing it in an organized way.
Right. No, I think an awful lot of people share the same reality that you're speaking of. And they need a clear program to follow that sort of leads them and their dogs step by step through the training process. I can say for myself, having been working with dogs for over 40 years, that sometimes dog literature and how to train your dog books can sometimes be dry and difficult to get through. And so what we've really tried to do in this most recent book, The Art of Training Your Dog, is provide owners with not only a rationale of why this can be such an effective approach, but also spell out with a organized lesson plan that is clear, it's sequential, it would be very difficult for the conscientious owner to mess up if they follow the guidelines that we provide in the book. And so that's what we're really trying to encourage, because you're right, this time of COVID gives owners just a marvelous opportunity to work more with their dogs. We're just trying to help them work intelligently.
So given that, as you just said, it's hard to mess this up, it is, and this by no means is a criticism of the program itself, but how much of that relies on because of the collar, that the collar is the thing that is really the magic bullet here?
Well, again, I think one of the things that we disabuse the reader of right from the get-go is that the collar is an absolute magic bullet, as you put it. First of all, there are real distinctions of the types of collars that are available. And in the book, we try and make very clear how there are plenty of collars that a potential dog owner and dog owner would want to avoid. You don't want to go to the local box you know, big box store and buy a $49 e-collar and slap it on your dog and think that that's going to be your magic bullet. That's a formula for real, real problems. Rather, what we explain is those models that we have confidence in that allow for the subtlety of STEM to be used in a way that communicates with the dog and can be understood easily with the dog. These are pieces of technology that are quite sophisticated, and in our own work, we've seen how they can really be used effectively. So there's no doubt that technology has sort of the genie is out of the bottle with respect to e-collars. I mean, over a million of these collars are sold every year, and we just simply want to give responsible guidance not only on how to use them, but also what types of collars, brand specifically, an owner can, let's say, invest in with confidence. Usually a good e-collar is going to probably run between $175 and $200, and that's a ballpark figure. But in the book, we describe a number of what we've found to be very reliable and good collars.
What actually happens with them? Is it a shock? Is it a noise? Is it a nudge? What is it?
It's not a shock at the level in which we're using it. We use often devices that have a rheostatic function, which allows them to be manipulated in very, very low levels. And so if you're familiar with, for example, a TENS unit in physical therapy, where there's a very mild stim that is that gives a light and electrical impulse just beneath the skin, okay, in physical therapy, it's analogous to how a modern-day e-collar can be used, where what we're looking for is just that level of response from the dog to indicate that it feels and gets the dog's attention. And so, for example, on some of the collars that we use, you might have a range of from 0 to 100, for example. And typically, the levels that we're using are under 10, okay, which for most human beings would be even difficult to feel in your hand. And so essentially in the process, what the dog feels in a very sort of subtle way, it's like a tap on the shoulder, and you simply want to get that very natural and very relaxed response of looking up that indicates that, you know, you have the dog's attention.
Does the breed of the dog matter?
Yes, but within each breed, naturally, you're going to have variances based on the individual personalities of dogs. I think, as we all know, some dogs are going to be a little bit more of quick learners. Others are going to be a little bit more stubborn. So the training has to be, in a sense, tailored to the sensitivities of each particular dog. But the idea that, well, since beagles are very difficult to train in conventional training, that this is not going to work in any way but a punitive way, no, that's not true. The experience that I've had here really sort of belies that myth.
When you think about the challenges that we've talked about of training a dog and what makes it difficult, is the employing of this collar something that then becomes a constant, or is the plan and the hope that you will have to use it less?
No, that's a great question. And I think the way that I would answer it is this. In the training process, naturally the dog is going to be less and less dependent on having the collar on at all times. Okay, when we send a dog home after the dog has been trained, generally speaking, we ask the owners to follow a program where the dog's wearing the collar optimally for the following 3 months. And that's both to allow an appropriate transition from monastery to home and allow the owner to get very comfortable with it. But then, generally speaking, if they followed the follow-up program, they can fade the use of the collar, certainly in domestic situations and in a lot of ordinary training situations. And there, I think we would say that you would be using the collar more for simply off-leash situations where distractions can come up in a way that you don't necessarily anticipate. For example, if you're taking a walk in the woods and all of a sudden the dog sees a deer, in that particular type of situation, the dog having an e-collar on can be really helpful because you can easily redirect the dog's focus, whereas if you're just simply yelling or, you know, trying to call the dog, you know, it might go in one ear and out the other. I mean, one of the things that I've found in my work with dogs is that no dog is absolutely distraction-proof. No dog. Dogs are not robots. And so being in a situation where I can respond to something I don't anticipate, to me, makes sense when it's an off-leash situation. So that would be the caveat that I would bring to it. But no, for most situations, after the dog has been trained and the follow-through has occurred, you're going to be able to fade the use of the e-collar.
So back to the six-month-old lab. You know what labs are like, and again, I guess this is similar to the question that I asked you about: is this breed specific? But do you see for large dogs, especially like labs, because I know you work so much with German Shepherds as well, that it is successful in that breed?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, because of their popularity, for sure. Both myself here at the monastery, as well as my colleague Mark Goldberg in his training establishment in Illinois, we see an awful lot of labs. And, you know, they're a breed that everyone loves. You cannot dislike Labrador Retrievers. They're a wonderful breed. They have immense intelligence, good nature. But they're lively, and yeah, they can also be mischievous. And, you know, we have found certainly Labradors do really, really well in this particular training program. You know, like I said, in many respects, I love it when a lab is coming in, because often we can expect that in a very, very quick amount of time, they are responding really well to the training. It's, you know, it's usually just a joy to work with them.
Is it ever too late? Meaning that, I mean, I have a 6-month-old dog and I have a 10-year-old dog. Is it ever too late to start employing this program?
Not really. Not in the way that most people think. You know, for example, a couple of years ago, I had a client who is relocating to London, England, and they had an 8.5-year-old dog that they wanted to be able to take advantage of the park across the street where they would be living in London, but the dog had to be off-leash reliable, okay, to be able to play in that particular park. And so they knew that before they left, that the dog was in no way that, you know, reliable off leash. And so they brought the dog to the monastery for training. And I got a postcard after about, you know, a couple of months after the dog had gone back home. And the people, it was a postcard from London, England, thanking us and saying that, you know, the dog was doing great and enjoying playing with the dogs in the park, and that they really felt that they had good control over the dog. So that was really nice and gratifying. But that dog was 8.5 years old.
Yeah.
So the idea, depending on what you're dealing with in terms of behavior, you know, you might have deep-seated problems that haven't been addressed over a time, and so you might need to, as it were, work at those problems in a more patient manner simply because the dog is so almost programmed to act in, let's say, ways that you don't want. But to say that a dog is too old for training, I wouldn't put it that way at all.
Well, and of course, you know, for millennia, we've heard the term, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. So that's, you know,
right.
One of the reasons I asked it. Is the, and I can leave it here as the final question, but when you look at this and you say, okay, this is something I have so often heard, and I think you and I have even had this conversation, where as with training, And from your series and from your previous books, I was always under the impression you were training us, the dog companion, more than you were training the dog. This seems to be more of training the dog.
Well, actually, it's both, because it's really important, okay, that training serves the relationship between owner and dog. One of the things that we're most well known for here at the monastery is not only training dogs and owners, but also emphasizing the spiritual dimension that's present in the human-dog relationship, which owners, dog owners, sort of get regardless of whatever religious tradition they come from or lack thereof. I think dogs and humans have this special bond, and that's one of the things that we're trying to allow to expand and owners to sort of realize their dreams. Now, with respect to this particular approach, okay, while it's helpful, okay, the tool is helpful in helping the dog achieve this high type of relationship, so to speak, it's really, really important for owners to understand how to use the tool effectively. And that's what sort of motivated us to write this book in the first place, is because up until now, there really hasn't been a book that details to the extent that this one does the whole process and how to take advantage of this tool. We just felt that there are too many stories where, let's say, an owner will go to a store, buy an e-collar, slap it on the dog, and expect that this is going to solve the problems. That's a formula for real, real problems, and we emphasize that in the book in multiple places. It's very, very important that an owner be clear into how to use this in a humane way, in a way that really serves the relationship and doesn't compromise it.
And finally, the things that I have heard from people who have been ambivalent and have been concerned of using them, and I would certainly put myself in that category, that they have told me that, yes, they have overcome these concerns. And the reason why is because ultimately they're trying to keep the dog alive.
They
don't want it
right.
They want to keep it safe and around and not have it run into Route 22.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely the case. All an owner has to do is go through one tragedy where they've lost a dog because the dog has either been hit by a car or had another unfortunate incident. That's one of the things that we're trying to capitalize on with this particular approach, is helping owners be comfortable with the idea of having their dogs off-leash in a safe way.
The name of the book is The Art of Training Your Dog, How to Gently Teach Good Behavior Using an E-Collar. It is by the monks of Newskeet. Brother Christopher has been our guest. Thank you so much for being with us. It's always a delight to speak with you, and I thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much, Joe. It's been a pleasure being with you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Art of Training Your Dog. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.